Welcome to TFP, the Theater Folk Podcast, the place to be for drama teachers, drama students, and theater educators everywhere. I'm Lindsay Price, resident playwright for Theater Folk. Hello. I hope you're well. Thanks for listening. This is episode 148. You can find any links to this episode in the show notes at theaterfolk.com/episode148. Okay, so today I am talking to Trina Baring. And Trina started out her career working in educational television for PBS and has hit a number of different writing forms along the way. And I like this conversation, and this is a great conversation about what makes different genres unique and what makes writing as good as it can be. It's a really awesome thing to have a playwright in our catalog who also has dipped their toe into a bunch of different formats. I think it's an amazing thing to be multifaceted as a writer. And that's why this conversation, I think we should get right into it, right? Let's get into it. Let's go. Okay, today I give the pleasure of talking to Trina Wooten Baring. Hello, Trina.
Hi.
And Trina is a new to Theater Folk playwright this year. She wrote a play called Almost History, that whole space-time continuum thing. And it's an awesome title because it tells you so much, right? It tells you that we know something about history is happening, but we also know that it is it's a little perhaps left of center, a little wonky. But we're going to get into that. First, hello, how are you?
I'm good. And hello to everybody.
Awesome. That's great. So, Trina, the first thing that I want to talk to you about is that you have a fabulous sort of multi-career background in a whole bunch of different parts of the arts. And none of it is steeped in theater. So I'm fascinated. It's so fascinating when we get these plays because we don't know who the playwrights are, and we're only going on, will this play work for our audiences? So when I went back and I looked at your bio again, I was like, oh, this is going to be fun stuff. But then, so that's my first question to you. Where's your background in theater? Is there something in the distant past that sort of started you on that path?
Yes, and actually in high school, actually a little bit before that, I think it was when I was about 10 or 11, I joined a local theater company just as an actor and to get training in that. Our area, I grew up in South Florida, and we had great community theaters, and they had classes for young people, and they had plays that they put on that you could try out for, and so I did that from about the age of 10 on, and that's where I really found my love for plays and theater and acting. I was in summer stock in Florida. I was actually the maid in Private Lives when I was 15, you know, tiny little part, but I got to work with professional actors and work around theater. So that was my youth background. Then I knew that I wanted to get into writing and directing somehow. And I also am just a very visual person, so I went to undergraduate school in broadcasting and film. And I ended up graduating and going directly into working with PBS affiliate in my home state of Mississippi. And there I did educational programming. I started out working my way up the ladder from an assistant doing logging and that kind of thing to going and directing children's programming and script writing for them and script editing especially. Then, like you said, eclectic career. I decided to go back and get my master's degree in education so that I would know a little bit more about what I was doing with technology. This was before before computers were really in everything, and that was the new and cutting edge field, and this was something I wanted to learn more about, the educational theory behind all this. So I went back and got my master's degree in educational technologies. And then, just on a personal note, I got married to someone who was moving to Germany. And so I moved to Germany, and that kind of interrupted the whole trajectory of working in television for a while there. And then that's when I started finding a way to be in the arts and in other ways that involved raising a family and moving around with a science husband who got different positions in different places. And so that's how I ended up writing on my own, and also doing the other types of work that I do with poetry editing and poetry and that kind of thing.
I think it's such a good point that to say, you know, having a career in the arts or having arts in your life is not necessarily have to be a narrow track. And I think a lot of students, and I think this is not necessarily for today's students, I think this was always the way. It's like, you know, if you're going to be in theater, well, it's better be acting, right? Or if you're going to be in TV, it has to be this one thing. And that's not necessarily the case.
No, it's not. And the thing about careers in theater and or careers in television, and I've talked to young people about this when, you know, I go to talk about the play with the theater director, and the actors are the ones up front. In television, we call them the talent. And then there, for every actor, there are about 10 other positions that are creative and that have real input into the creation that ends up being that night that the curtain goes up, or that program that gets broadcast, or that film that gets projected. That's, there's so many people involved in the creation of that whose names aren't the first ones that come up on the screen or in the program up front. But those careers and though that input is really a great way to have your creativity out there and to work in the arts and to have something that you've created and make a contribution to something creative.
I love that. It's not a statistic, but it's a piece of numbers, you know, like for one talent, there's 10 other people who are also working to make this creative thing happen. Love that. Okay.
So yeah, at least, because in some films, it's 1 to 500. When you get into animation, graphics, and that kind of thing, it takes that many more people.
So let's hover on your television, your stuff for just a bit, because I know that people listening have students who have that star in their eye, or, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to work in television? And I'll admit, when I had a very tiny foray into writing for television, and way back when, enough to make for me to go, yeah, I don't need to do that anymore. But what, when you started into it, because this was your first career, so you were, you know, same age as a lot of our teenagers, and what was your biggest misconception about what your career was going to be like?
Biggest misconception. I think the first thing that I realized was that you're going to have to pay your dues. And that is that when you get into something like television, not everybody is going to fall down and say, you're the best writer we've ever had, and here, let's put you as head of the entire writing group right now as a 20-year-old, which is, I guess I was about 21 when I got my first professional job in television. And so I paid my dues. I realized, wow, okay, I'm going to have to sit in a little small room with a computer and a pen, or nowadays it would be a keyboard and an iPad, and log all of this film that some other director went out there and shot, and I'm going to have to write down, you know, for documentaries, this is how I started, writing down, you know, at 2:14 for 6 minutes, this medium shot of the ship and that kind of, all that has to be logged in so they can, the editors can find it. And that was a lot of tedious hours of doing that. And, everybody says that's paying your dues, but you learn so much by doing that. And I worked with people who were willing to mentor me as well and say, okay, you look like you have an eye for this. Let me show you what I know as well. And I think that mentorship is very important. And I work now with a women's organization, and that's one for the arts. And that's one thing that we work on. As I get older, I want to mentor young people as well to bring them up, because that's how you learn, is from people who have come before you. So
I think it's the most fabulous way to learn, instead of, it's not a book. It's not a test. I did the failing. Here, let me pass something on to you to, add to your toolkit.
And to take what they say and think, okay, I had a degree in broadcasting, and so I had done broadcasting in a university setting. We had done classes that were practicums where you actually made little TV shows and that kind of thing. And now everybody can do that on an iPad and, just hold it up and make a movie. So people have a lot more experience now even. But getting into a setting where you've got someone who says, okay, this is great. Let's go with this. Let's try this. Let's go with where we can go with this and who believes in you and that you can learn from too.
What was it like what's very unique about script writing in the television genre?
Script writing for television, I think the biggest thing is that you've got to balance what's happening on the screen with the dialogue, with moving the plot along. Because in a theater setting, you can be a little more wordy, you can be a little more talky, and you can have things happen that are explored in greater detail. When you work with television, you've got to get it out there, you've got to say what you need to say as quickly as possible, as short as possible. I just looked at the script out of curiosity for 12 Years a Slave, and it's amazing how short all the lines are. And yet they conveyed so much information in those short lines. And writing for television or writing for film, you've got that balance between what's being said and then what is the visual that goes with it that can also convey information.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I've just started, I'm way late to the party, but I just started watching Mad Men. And that's one of the things I noticed. So yes, there's a lot of, they do these, juicy things that Don Draper gets to say, but there's also a lot of silence in terms of all you are doing is seeing someone react. And that's the inner monologue that we would write in theater. In TV or movies, there shouldn't be any words. We should just see it, the physicality of it.
And that visual communication is, I think, more important in television and film. And the script writer has a role in that. Those scripts do convey that. The director will take it and do things with it and set it up, but the script writer, a good script writer, will have that all in there so that that the director can take it. And I've worked on both sides of that equation. I've worked with other people's scripts, and then I've worked with directors using my scripts. And you hone both sides of that talent, looking at it and saying, okay, I've got to get this so the director knows exactly what I'm trying to convey with this scene, so that they can't, in a way, misinterpret it and have it be something that you didn't really mean by that. So you want to write the directions, and you want to write the visuals and the inner dialogue, the inner monologue of what's going on with that actor, so that the director and the actor really understands what's happening there. Like, you might have a scene where, the person reacts and the line might be, oh, really? But the direction might be, look skeptical, or looks surprised or looks like, oh, I didn't understand that before. So those directions can tell you what the meaning behind those lines are. And a good script writer will include those. I've read a couple of scripts lately where they translate something like Jane Austen into script form. And Emma Thompson's is like one of the greatest. And she actually takes Jane Austen's writing and puts it in that direction so that actors can understand, oh, that's what's meant by this.
It's a fascinating thing about just why books and movies are not the same thing, right? And I think that's what you've just said is it in a nutshell, is that it's, you need to take the words and make it a visual a director can follow.
And something that the director can then say, okay, that, because the director is going to work with the actors and the actors are going to interpret the character and the motivations. And the more the script writer gives good guidance on that, the more that the script writer will be satisfied with the production. And I learned, you know, when I was first starting out, I would write things that I thought were clear, but that really weren't. And so I learned, okay, if I want this to be obvious, I have to say it. And that's not to say that you write rambling directions that are so elaborate that the director goes, ah, but just that you know, whatever. But that you write something that's clear and that conveys the emotional content as well, because that's the other thing about writing for television. And I think this is true for theater as well, that you want the emotional motivation to be true.
Well, that's what we're connecting to, isn't it? That's what an audience wants. They want to have an emotional reaction. And it doesn't matter if the person on stage or the person on screen is going through something that they've never been through. If there's an emotion attached, the person in the audience can go, oh, okay, sadness or anger or frustration, and I get that.
And how that emotional content gets conveyed is the script writer's first task. And then there is some letting go that happens, that you trust your actors to bring it to another level as well.
Absolutely. Okay. So you've written scripts for TV and also for the stage, which we're going to get into just in a sec. Almost history, that whole space time continuum thing, and poetry as well. What's your favorite type of writing?
Oh, whatever inspiration is.
Whatever is happening right now.
It's an interesting thing is I've been working on the same novel. I'm writing this novel. I've got about 20 in my head at any given time. And I've been working on the same novel for about 6 years. And when I wrote the play, I wrote it in a day and a half. I wrote it one weekend. So, you know, whatever comes easily, I think is. So after I wrote this play, the Almost History play, I thought, okay, I probably should go back to playwriting because this was a whole bunch easier than the other things I've tried. Poetry is always really nice because poetry is another case where, like script writing, where you're taking something that might be kind of disparate and out there and cloudy and distilling it down into that perfect teardrop of meaning. Mm-hmm. And that's when you get to find the perfect word for the situation and to put it into a form that is basically short, which doesn't mean it's easier, because in a lot of ways it's even more difficult to get it really distilled down into something understandable. So I don't know. I don't have a favorite. I like wherever inspiration takes me. And in spite of the craft of it, I think that really it's really important in writing to love what you're doing. I'm always a little bit in love with whatever my current project is. It's kind of like a new boyfriend. And then that you get to play out that feeling of being in love and, oh, wow, this is, I've got this idea, you know, type, 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 type. And then you get to go back and look at the craft of it and hone it and be a little more deliberate about the craft of it.
I think that's a great way to put it, that's a good difference between a first draft and a second draft, isn't it? You know, the first draft is just, you know, love on the page, and then the second draft is craft on the page and sort of, and think about the why.
And I, people work differently. I tend to be more talkative, obviously, so I tend to be longer winded when I'm writing, and then I have to go back and cut things out instead of adding. Some people get the skeleton down and then they have to flesh it out. I tend to get a big fat person that I have to put on a diet.
I'm the same way. I have a great relationship with a teacher who I give my stuff to, and she'll, you know, read a monologue and go, XYZ. And I'll go, okay. And then to sort of like take that monologue and then like really start to distill it and cut it down and then write the one sentence that actually the whole monologue was trying to say. And then it's like, you know, that's like cheesecake for the rest of the day. If I can get something down into one sentence, that is my favorite thing as a writer.
Well, and that's an interesting point, because I think if you've looked at it and you can't, like people say, you know, this novel I've been writing, they say, what is it about? And for a long time, I couldn't really say what it was about. Well, that's a big warning sign if you can't. If you can't write the blurb for it, then maybe you need to think about, well, what is the blurb? What is, you know, what are you really trying to convey? What are you trying to write about? Because that's the question people will say, well, what is it about? And it could be like, you know, Wuthering Heights. What is that about? You can come up with that. The novels today that you read, or the plays that you read, or Mad Men. You know, what is that about? It's about this Don Draper guy that, you know, you can find what it's about.
Well, and you should be able to take your work and distill it into one sentence. I think that's a great exercise for the classroom too, because I find students, that's the one thing that they miss, is that they, okay, I have these characters and I'm going to make them funny and we're going to go and we're going to be in Germany in this scene and then we're going to be on the beach in this scene. But then it's like, when you ask them what it's about, they don't have a conflict and they don't have a thesis, essentially. And once you do, things become much clearer, because then everything has to support the thesis, which is a very, I know that's, it's a very, I don't, in,
not teachery.
Teachery. That's, yeah, that's it exactly. Except that's true.
It is true. And when you look at, you know, when somebody asks you what it's about and you have to really think, well, what is it about? Then it really makes you think, well, what do I think, you know, even what does my left brain, right brain, you know, can they communicate with each other what it's about? And can, you know, can I say for sure that this is where I want to go with it? And what am I really, what do I need to load in there? I know, you know, when you say everything has to support the thesis, there's a lot of room for things to support the thesis if your thesis is really the essence of it. Mm-hmm. If you've written a thesis that's maybe doesn't really encompass it, then you might have trouble. Like if your thesis is too narrow, then you're going, or your idea is too narrow, then you might have trouble getting everything to fit that.
And a great example, I think, is that if you look, just because that's what's on my brain right now, is I think about Mad Men. I think about the thesis being the perfect world of ads versus the messy world, the messy real world, right? That's in my interpretation. But I just think there's so much, just as you say, there's so much that you can explore with that, with the characters and with storylines and all that other stuff.
And it doesn't have to get old. You know, those things can have a lot of fresh takes on them.
Absolutely. Okay. So as a script writer, novelist now, and poet.
Unfinished.
Hey man. It's on the page, somewhere. It's right in a novelist. And so Almost History, that whole space-time continuum thing. So where did this come from?
Yeah, this was this. I was up in Virginia. I live in Houston, and we'd gone up to DC and, you know, had a big trip around, and we went to Monticello. And there was Jefferson's study, and there was his grave, and there was a lot of talk about how he and John Adams fought all their, had real arguments, real theoretical and political arguments over their lifetime. And then the story goes, the American myth is that they died on the same day. I think, you know, that's the, on July 4th, which I think is an amazing fact. And so I got to kind of thinking about how the image of the founding fathers as squabbling, squabbling children, even though they were adults, that they were squabbling with each other, and how funny it would be to have a scene with that. So that scene, there's to just give a little background about the play, it goes through American history, and it's got a time travel element, and it's got a messing up the whole space-time continuum thing element, but it has scenes throughout American history, sort of seminal moments in American history. And that was the first scene that I wrote, was the scene about the founding fathers. And I just thought, in my mind, it came to me that, okay, we have these squabbling founding fathers, and we have someone from today who's trying to learn history and is watching this, and who's all confused about all this history because they're really not learning history all that accurately. They're just Googling it and finding out little fun facts here and there. And then what if they messed up that history? Like that scene is they knock over the ink and ruin the Declaration of Independence, and it kind of throws a spanner in the works of everything. And so that's where that came from. And I just love time travel stuff. I think middle school kids love time travel. All their books are all into that. And so the idea of people of somebody modern going back in time and doing that, you know, messing something up just seemed like a great way to key into what middle schoolers like and are interested in. Plus, I just thought it was funny. The idea is, you know, some of the funny things came to me, and I have a quirky sense of humor, and I wanted to, you know, that the I guess I'm laughing at my own jokes while I was writing it. So,
well, it's a great look at when we talk about this whole notion of what is cross curricular for our listeners. That's their thing, particularly in the drama classroom, about what they sometimes have to do is like link what they do into other classes, and to take moments from history and make those people human and not statistics or dates on a page, I think is a really effective way of exploring history. And why not make them funny? And, you know, like, why not make Einstein and Marie Curie, you know, have a sense of humor?
Well, they did. In real life, they did. So that, you know, I don't think it's too irreverent, the play. I was hoping that it wasn't too irreverent toward American history and toward our most cherished figures in American history. But it is this idea that these reporters go back and just really get things wrong and mess things up. That would just had a lot of goofy possibilities. But it also had a lot of possibilities of bringing those characters to life and have those characters up there where they were really interacting with the characters too, and where it wasn't so heavy-handed a curriculum. But I had people come up to me after and say, wow, I really learned a lot from that. I didn't know all these things. And the last line of the play is, well, and if you learn something, we apologize. So, you know, it's...
Well, that's the best way to learn, isn't it? When you're when you're enjoying something and it becomes part of your knowledge.
And to see it come to life, too, in a way that, okay. And also, one of the things that comes out in the play was that everything that happened in these timelines of American history affects who we are now. There's a scene with the Declaration of Independence, and if that doesn't happen the way it's supposed to, we're a different country now. And that the different scenes are, there's the founding fathers, there's Columbus, for instance. So it starts out with Columbus's ships and acknowledges the controversy about Columbus and who he was, and acknowledges that there are different viewpoints. That's the other thing I wanted to point out too in the play, was that history is not a static, just words on a page, there it is, and that's it, and this is what you have to learn. There are different ways of looking at, people have different ways of looking at the same historical events. Someone has a, you know, Columbus is a hero to a lot of people, but he's also an invader to others. So acknowledging that and saying, you know, it doesn't get too heavy-handed into that. Believe me, it doesn't go deep. It is middle school.
Okay, so I was going to ask you the question, what the thesis of your play was, since we're talking about, you know, how do we, like, you know, describe our writing in one sentence. But then you beat me to it. I like history is not static as a thesis for this play. I was going to go with the past is connected to the present.
Yeah, that's true. I think also, I guess when I had it in mind, it was that it's important to learn history because we need to figure out where we are now by where we've been too. That history is important to learn, that otherwise you can mess up that whole space-time continuum thing.
Absolutely. Well, and that's the thing that I think a lot of students, and again, I think people say this about today's students, but quite frankly, I think we were all guilty of this, is that we all live in, at that, when we're that age, we live in the now, right? With little blinders on, and we don't have a concept of where we've come from.
Yeah, there's something I was reading about this the other day, the bias of the now, which makes people think this is the best tennis player in the entire history of the world just because they're winning now. And, you know, that you look back and that's what they thought about some tennis player in the 1920s too. So there is that. And I think that there's also this idea that history is snoozeville. And it's not. It's really fun. And it's really, there are a lot of good characters in it. And there are also a lot of interesting ways of analyzing it and looking at it and thinking about what if this had happened a different way? Where would we be now? It would be in a different place. There's the space race. What if that had gone a different way? I didn't really do this that intentionally in the play. I was writing a nice, like, funny play. Hopefully funny, but, that's all in there too.
Well, and it's true. It's because history has become a litany of, this happened in 1773 and this happened in 1863. We don't think about these individuals in history as people and that, hey, guess what? Some of them probably, swore a lot, and some of them probably smoked, and some of them had, they liked eating, ice cream for breakfast is the only thing that comes to mind, even if they didn't have ice cream. But it's all these things that we do. And at any time that we can take folks from history and just, again, it's all about emotion and humanity, whether it's for a laugh or for not, I think it's valuable.
And it's worth knowing. It's worth knowing who Jefferson was. I mean, I started with Jefferson, but there are a lot of other characters that come up in the course of things, a lot of real heroes. Alexander Graham Bell was a real hero. I mean, he really worked on this and really got us the technology that we have today. And so it's worth going back and seeing, you know, Marie Curie and Einstein. You know, these are people that contributed but that doesn't mean they are not human and that they don't have their foibles.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, so as we wrap up, I think that that's what we're sort of landing on here today, is that history is about humanity and writing is about humanity. And if we can find that, whether you're going to write it in a script, or you're going to write it in a poem, or you're going to write it in a play about Ben Franklin and Alexander Graham Bell, I say that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And go with your gut feeling on it. If you're a writer, if you're a director, go with how it makes you feel too.
Love it. All right. Trina, it's been a delight talking to you. It's been lovely, and let's everyone remember that play name, Almost History, that whole space-time continuum thing where a reporter and a sidekick sort of live stream great moments from American history with some mishaps along the way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Trina. Okay, before we go, let's do some theater folk news. It's a play feature. It's a play feature. It's time to feature a play. And it is Trina Behring's Almost History, the whole space-time continuum thing. So, we've got time travel. We have middle school. We have history. Yes, one of these things seems not like the other, but keep on, dear listener. Please keep on. History is not static, right? People have so many different ways at looking at historical events and how the past is connected to the present. And that's sort of the underlying theme in this play. In a hilarious series of time-traveling misadventures, a reporter and a sidekick live stream from great moments in American history. And despite the uber-scientist sidekick's best efforts to keep the clueless reporter out of trouble, she gets in trouble. And they change the course of history and return to a chaotic but comedic present. Even Einstein and Marie Curie cannot undo the disastrous effects of their mishaps. Eventually, they are able to save democracy and technology by restoring order to, you guessed it, that whole space-time continuum thing. Want to make history human? Do you want an awesome cross-curricular experience for your students? Do you want to see Marie Curie with a sense of humor? Almost History, the whole space-time continuum thing by Trina Behring. You can check out this play at theaterfolk.com. You can also find the link in the show notes, theaterfolk.com/148. Finally, where can you find this podcast? We post new episodes every second Tuesday at theaterfolk.com and on our Facebook page and Twitter. You can find us on youtube.com/theaterfolk, and you can find us on the Stitcher app. You can also subscribe to TFP on iTunes. Isn't that awesome? All you have to do is search for the word Theater Folk. And that's where we're going to end. Take care, my friends. Take care.